User personas are fictional characters or archetypes that represent a segment of your users. They bring tons of benefits to charities. They allow you to practice precise targeting, streamline volunteer management, improve donor retention and recruitment, boost efficiency around service delivery, and so much more. In short, personas can significantly enhance so many areas of charity operations. So today we are going to deep dive into user personas. We will discuss, among other things, why charities need personas, how to develop them, how to make the most of them, the roadblocks you might face, and so much more. I'm joined by two people with vast practical experience of user personas, Angela Richmond of Red Fox Research and Jen Lothrop of Feel Good, Do Good. Just to let you know that the present episode is recorded at home, so there may be some background noises or connectivity issues, and you can blame Zoom. So, without further ado, let's move to the first question. Why do we need user personas and what are the benefits? I'll start with you, Angela.
Yeah, well, I think user personas are very closely related to segments, but segments can be quite detailed and sometimes quite dry because they're based on a lot of data, a lot of behavioural information. Personas are there really as a pen portrait. Some people call them muses, so they're really an idea of an ideal customer, donor, you know, whatever segment you're working in. They're an ideal target that you can hold in your head as an organization to think about how you can create messaging that will resonate with them, how you can create fundraising events that will tie into their motivations, how you can create campaigns. So they're just a little kind of shorthand, really.
Bro, Jen?
Yeah, I mean, I love user personas, use them with a lot of my clients when working on things like digital marketing strategies. I just think they're a really core element of better understanding your audience. I mean, it's really about digging into almost putting yourself in the mind of particular target audiences. So it's like, what is it that they want from you and what is it you want from them? And that's kind of some of the core. And once you know that, you can start to match up kind of what will work so that you're getting what you need and they're getting what they need. It's really about kind of, yeah, putting yourself in the mind of them. Think about what is it that makes them really happy? What is it that really frustrates them? And all of that can help you create better kind of targeted communications on social media, in your newsletters. And also it kind of focuses the mind because people have a tendency to say, oh, well, my audience is everyone. Nobody's audience is everyone. It's kind of natural to think that a lot of the time, but actually when you start to kind of niche down and focus in on some of the core audience members, you can target things better rather than having that kind of broad brush approach. And there'll still be, you know, there's a lot of overlap with audiences. What might be right for a single mum might and sometimes overlap with what a teenager wants or what a retired person wants. But there's also like differences in that. And so you can really kind of focus different communications on different audiences. And it's just that visual representation. So when you're creating comms or whatever it is, or developing a new website, you can really be thinking, right, are we achieving the needs of all these different audience members?
Definitely. I mean, the benefits are quite wide ranging. I mean, from our part, we saw one of the big things for us was we made a lot of decisions based on assumptions. And I think that's one of the things that this helps to tackle, because, you know, assumptions only get you so far, and you can be as sort of informed as you want and believe you know your audience. But I think that's where this helps you focus a little bit more. Can we talk a little bit about the other benefits they can bring? Anything that, you know, charities should know about, really?
Yeah, I mean, it's ultimately, when it comes to like fundraising, I think really thinking about who it is you're trying to donate. So whether it could be individual giving fundraising, so then it's kind of things you're sharing on your Facebook or your Instagram, or it could be more about high net worth donors. They're all very different audiences, and the communications that you're going to use with them are going to be very different. And it might be even maybe you're going for a meeting with a potential grant funder or a potential high net worth worth donor. And before you go, you can kind of look at your persona or personas that are related to that audience and kind of just refresh your mind a bit on kind of what are the things that I shouldn't say that are going to work for that audience. And interesting what you said about assumptions, because it's true, like we have a lot of assumptions in our minds. It's our bias and stuff is kind of natural to all humans, and sometimes personas can start being a little bit can start based on assumptions, but the idea is that you have to keep kind of adding that data and insight to make them as real as possible. And I often say to people when they're kind of starting out with creating personas that sometimes you can actually base them on real people. Obviously always give them a different name and some different characteristics, just in case they come around and see themselves on your wall in the office. But actually sometimes that kind of real life data that can be on actual phrases that people say and can really kind of help, again, kind of focus on what it is that audience wants. One of my favorite parts of creating a persona is I always try and do a quote of like, what is the thing that this person would say a lot? So it could be things like, oh, I just hate websites that aren't mobile friendly. And that could be just like their bugbear that they're always saying. And so you know that when you're thinking about that person, right, this person is never on their laptop, they're always going to be on the phone, it needs to be suitable for them. So I think that little quote can sometimes kind of sum up what works for that person, and it can be quite fun as well.
And I think, Jen, as well, I think that they can be very visual. You know, I think the great thing about a persona is that, you know, you can bring it to life with a little picture or even a collage or a mood board of the sorts of things that motivate the people that you're aiming for. I mean, I think one of the other things about personas is that they can be quite aspirational. They can be future looking. So you don't necessarily always want your personas to be tied to what's worked for you in the past. You know, you can be thinking about how things are changing. So if we think about the charity sector, you know, we know that there's a trend away from things like regular giving. We know that there's a change away from very passive giving. So charities will need to think about the sorts of people that will get more involved in fundraising events, the people that will drive those fundraising events. So they almost need to kind of start to imagine the sort of donor or the sort of fundraiser that they would like to be targeting in the future, as well as the people that are kind of creating value for the charity at the moment. But I think, yeah, anything that brings it to life. And remember, I mean, you're talking about if you're going out to, you know, to stakeholders or whatever. Remember that different people think in different ways. For some people that you're talking to, that quote will be the thing that they remember. For other people, it will be a stat that they remember. For some people, it will be the little, you know, literally the little visual that you put in front of them. So I think it's worth spending time finessing the personas, you know, and thinking about what your deliverable is, essentially.
Yeah,
definitely. I can't remember who told me this a while ago, and I feel like I use this in lots of times when I'm talking about personas, but I think it's Macmillan used them quite a lot, and particularly for their like coffee mornings, the Macmillan coffee mornings. So like whenever they're creating, promoting their coffee mornings, they'll have these different personas. They'll be think like, oh, what is it that Jane wants from this? What is it that Mohammed wants from this? What is it? You know, it's like, it's really kind of actually, you know, Jane isn't on Facebook, so she's still looking at posters in her village hall. So we need to make sure we do posters, and those posters should have pictures of, I don't know, people sat around a table having fun, as opposed to people eating cake. Or it's you know, simplistic, but it's thinking of it really kind of sticking. So at Macmillan, I don't know if they still do, but they used to have them like stuck up in their wall in their office. A bit harder now with everyone working from home, but I think kind of having, as you say, that visual representation and just having it in front of you. So all the time when you're like writing a Facebook post or you're having a comms planning session or whatever it is, you're kind of looking at that on the wall and being like, oh, what is it that Jane? No, that's not going to work for Jane. We need to make sure that we've covered this, or she's going to miss it, or she's not going to be interested. So yeah, really kind of putting yourself in their shoes.
Yeah, that was brilliant. Thanks both. I think to move on a little bit to get into the nitty gritty, we could talk a bit about actually developing them. So what would be, let's start just with that. Like, what would be your first steps, or how would you go about doing it? Because it is a lot more, sometimes I find these things a lot more theory than practice. And so it's good to give people actual, you know, guidance. Angela?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is that there's so many different routes that you can go, actually. Mm. And some of it will depend on what data and information you've got available to you. Some of it will depend on how much you've got in the way of resources available to you. So, you know, the first thing I would say is start with the data that you've got in front of you. You know, start with who are your most valuable supporters? Who are the sorts of supporters that you're communicating with the most? Because they're not necessarily both the same thing. You know, there might be a very small group of people out there that are going to create the most value and donations for you. And also, I think you have to think a little bit about who you can actually influence, because it's no good coming up with a persona if it's somebody that you can't really talk to. You know, I mean, Jen was talking about, you know, how do we communicate with so-and-so who's on Facebook, who's not on Facebook. You need to be thinking about those people as well. So I think you can start looking at the data that you've got. I think the other thing is that you need to add a lot of qualitative information to them. So they shouldn't just be about numbers. Now, there's different ways to get access to that. You can do workshops internally. You know, it's very likely that your employees will have a good feel for who some of these people are. But probably at some point you're going to want to get out there and start having some conversations with supporters and potential supporters to understand what makes them tick. And I think that's where qualitative market research comes in. So, you know, when we're helping clients build personas, we typically be recruiting, we'd be recruiting members of the public to talk to them, to explore why they may or may not want to get involved in a charity, you know, what sort of triggered their involvement in the past, little bits about their life, you know, not necessarily directly to do with charities. Because I think that, I mean, again, it comes back to that aspirational and future looking mm-hmm. thing. There's always a danger of just carrying on with the kind of information and viewpoint that you've always had, you know, and you don't move forward if you do that. If you just carry on working in a kind of echo chamber, you won't be able to develop. So I think it's really important to get out there and talk to people. And that can be informally as well. You know, you may not have budget to do, you know, a big qualitative research project, but just talk to as many people as you can. Mm-hmm. And understand what makes them tick.
Yeah,
definitely. So when I do personas in kind of workshops and stuff when working with organisations, I have a couple of templates and I'll kind of tweak it depending on kind of what it is that they are aiming to achieve from these personas. So it'll have things kind of like, what's their IT experience? So, you know, what's their digital experience? Kind of, do they have laptops? Do they have phones? Are they on Facebook? Kind of, where are they in the kind of digital world or comms world? Kind of, it might be, what kind of papers do they read? So are they reading like left-wing papers, right-wing papers, like all that those kind of political views, kind of getting some of that background information. I'll also make sure that they give them a name, not a real one, an age, and again the age should be specific, not in their 30s but 36, or and whether they've got family, kids, what their hobbies are, all that kind of like background information I think is quite a good place to start. And then you get into the nitty-gritty. So again, as I said at the start, it's what do they want and what do you want from them, and obviously that needs to link to what it, if whatever it is you're trying to achieve. So for example, if it's about your website, what is useful to them on their website? What do they want from that? Do they want to know about how to fundraise? Do they want to be able to donate easily? Like, what is it that they're trying to do? And what is it that you want from them? And then I look at kind of like their things they love and things that they hate. So what makes them really happy and what makes them really frustrated? And so that's kind of a basic template. And I generally get people to do that. And it will, and again, the quote, but that would be partly based on assumptions plus things that they already know. So then once they've done that, it's about digging in to be like, right, what of this was based on assumptions? What of this is based on like the research and the facts and the stuff that we know? So I might do something like a knowledge board. So it's kind of like what we know, what we think we know, and what we don't know. And then from the what we think we know and what we don't know, that's where we go out to get more information. So it could be that you look at your social media analytics. It could be that you're looking at your website analytics. Or it could be that, as you were saying, Angela, you're going out and speaking to people and do some of that individual kind of conversations where you get some of that information. And again, it doesn't have to be loads of people. Like, you could just speak to kind of four or five people and you can get quite a lot of information from it. So that's kind of where I'd start. So it's kind of like, do something, draw a picture, add a picture from Photoshop, give them a name, give as much information as you can, and then go away and be like, right, how much of this have we just made up and how much of this is actually based on the information that we know? And that's where they should be kind of like evolving these personas. So you keep kind of adding to them over time as you glean more information. And that's why I quite like the kind of having them stuck up on your wall. And it'll be probably that different teams have different personas that they've got stuck up on their wall, because there might be the high net worth team, or there might be the individual giving team, or the events team. And so they're all going to have a series of different personas that are targeted on what they're trying to achieve. But yeah, so I guess when putting them together, it can start really simple, like print out a template and fill it in. And that's often what I do in workshops. But then it's really important to go back to the next stage of like, actually, this can't just be based on assumptions and made up. Like, we need to challenge our bias. We need to, you know, get the evidence for what we've said. And if we don't know, try and find out.
Yeah, and I think it's really important that they do evolve. And if you've got a really clear view and you've got that picture on your wall of who your persona is, that helps you if something externally changes. So, you know, if the cost of living crisis comes along, or, you know, we've just had this awful earthquake, you know, you want to be able to say, what would Daisy do? What would John do? You know, how are they going to react to those things? You should know your personas well enough to know how they would react when something new comes along that you haven't yet tested or discussed as a stakeholder group, because it then helps you act really quickly in those sorts of situations.
Yeah, definitely. And the other thing that I find quite useful for kind of information that can help develop your personas is just looking at, what are people asking questions about on Facebook? What are people direct messaging you about? What are people emailing you about? When you're at an event, what are the questions that people are asking? What are the, you know, all those kind of little bits of information, that is all really useful data of kind of like, oh, people are always asking that question, so we should make the answer to that really clear on our social media and people are going to be interested in it. Again, single mums isn't an obvious example, but like, what's important to the single mums? If they're coming to an event, they want to know that there's childcare, or they want to know that it's not very long, or they want to know that they can bring their kids, or, you know, it's kind of thinking of the things that are specific and finding that through contacts, communications that people have had with you.
I think there's no substitute for actually actively going and asking people, because I think there's a danger if you base too much on social media, for example, that the people that make the most noise aren't necessarily always representative, are they? So I think it's a good start. You know, if there's noise about something, then there's clearly a lot of people that think that. But I think it's always good to go out and actively ask the question, because sometimes you can be quite surprised by what the people that don't shout are thinking as well.
No, definitely. I think you need both. I think it's important. Just it's getting as much information from as many places as you can, but also not being too daunted by that, because if you're a small charity, it can be like, oh my God, there's information everywhere. So really thinking, what are some of the like quicker things you can do, and then what are some of the longer term, or you know, and as you say, just speaking to a handful of people can really help. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, that leads us nicely onto the final question. I was going to ask about what we can use them to do. I think the fundraising for from Red Fox was a great example of a practical user persona. You can see that on the Charity Digital site, there's an article about it. But I think we moved on a little bit to roadblocks and sort of talked about bias and things like that. And I think there's quite a lot of those in doing research. You run into hundreds. So can we talk a bit about the main roadblocks that charities can face, and if possible, maybe give them some advice about overcoming those roadblocks? I'll go to Angela to start.
Well, I think Jen highlighted one of them actually when she was just talking just now, because I think people get overwhelmed by the complexity of them, and they sometimes try to make this too complicated. I think when I see personas failing, as in not being used enough, it's because either there's too many of them, you know, and I would rather see one persona than eight personas, because nobody can really get their head around eight different personas. And people do tend to say, well, hang on a minute, there's somebody, you know, there's people that we talk to that don't quite fit that. So should we create another persona to sit alongside that? And that starts to get quite messy. So I think keeping it relatively simple in terms of the number of personas, but equally, if you don't have enough differentiation, that can also be difficult. So you don't want your persona to be so generic that it's, you know, anybody who donates to charity. You know, there's got to be something about it that makes it different, unique, somebody that you can talk to. But I think in terms of actually arriving at your persona, I think getting overwhelmed by the amount of information that you potentially have or can use, it is a downfall for people. So you just really need to kind of take a breath and take a step backwards. And there's probably somebody in your team that's good at sifting through that. And sometimes you have to kind of move away from the group. And I don't know whether Jen kind of comes across this when she's doing her internal workshops. You know, sometimes you have to move away from the group and say, can we really distill this down into something that makes sense to people rather than something that is just so big and noisy? If you can't fit a persona on one page, I think you've got a problem.
Yeah, definitely. It's keeping it as simple as possible, because if you've got too much information on there, no one's going to remember it. No one's going to read it. They're going to get shoved in a folder on your computer and never looked at again, which is why I quite like, even in this day and age, printing them out and sticking them up on your wall, or having them as your backdrop, or just having them and making them pretty. So I'll use, like, Canva has lots of templates. I generally use the CV template or something like that, that you can turn into a persona. So it's a nice, so it looks like something pretty and colourful. The other thing that I find is a bit of a blocker with creating personas is making sure you link it back to what that actually means for your actions as a charity. So it's very easy to be like, oh, this is what we want, this is what we want. And it's like, okay, so what does that actually mean? So spending a bit of time kind of like, so I know that I'm not going to post on Facebook for this person, for example. I know that I am going to use quite basic level English for this person. I know that I'm not going to be too like campaigny speak to this person, or I'm going to be very campaigny and quite like strong in my language to this person. So it's really kind of being quite specific on what that means for the actual actions you're going to do. So a lot of it could be around language. So kind of putting some example sentences kind of that messaging of what kind of messaging you would use for this person versus what you might use for this person, how you might title a newsletter, that kind of thing. And then things that you wouldn't do. So yeah, to me, I think it's that kind of final stage of what does that actually mean? Like, yes, we've got a beautiful, pretty persona stuck upon the wall. We know about Jane and what she wants from Macmillan, but what does that actually mean for our communications? And I think to me, that's kind of the important final stage. And then alongside that, which we alluded to before, is just keeping them up to date. And as Angela was talking, kind of seeing them a bit aspirational of kind of what could happen in the future. What do we want from them in the future? How have things changed? You know, they might have been one way, but now because of cost of living, things, you know, the way their whole life has changed or whatever it might be. It's really being aware of those and keeping them kind of up to date as best you can.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned something that was interesting, which the up-to-date point, I think, is something we can develop a bit more. How would a charity go about doing that? So I see them as ever-evolving, so your personas evolve. How regularly should they be updating their personas, do you think? And also, I'm curious about what you think is the sort of sweet spot for personas, because Angela, you said 8's too many, 1's preferable to 8. And of course, it will depend on resources and stuff like that. But any advice there on you know, how many there should be and how regularly you should actually update them?
I generally aim tell people for a maximum of 5. It's hard to get to 5, and they're often, but what about these people and what about these people? But the point is, you're trying to think about the most important and really kind of focus in on those with your communications. So I'd say kind of 3 to 5. But if they're a bigger organization, that they'll probably have more niched teams, then it might be kind of 3 to 5 per team. It really depends on the size of the organization and kind of their different focuses. In terms of keeping them up to date, it really varies, because some personas are unlikely to change massively in terms of their wants and needs and stuff, whereas others may well do. So it's being aware of things happening in the world that might change stuff, really. Mm-hmm. And also, one persona might become a different persona because they were a teenager and now they've got a family or whatever. So it's kind of evolving over time, seeing people age or change or their jobs change or whatever. So yeah, they might become a different one. But I think I don't know if I can put a number on it, a time on it in terms of being up to date. I'd say you want to check in on them probably every 6 months to a year. But really, it's if something major happens that you think might affect them, that's when you're like, okay, let's rethink. Like COVID, for example, that would have, you know,
cost a lot of living
at the water.
Yeah.
I mean, I think sometimes as well, you just have to look at how well they're being used and how successful they are. Sometimes there's cases where personas, it happens as well with segments and customer journeys, sometimes something just isn't quite executed right, and for that reason it doesn't get used a lot internally. So if you haven't managed to make them stick, I think you have to go and revisit them. So, you know, if you don't feel people are using the personas, if there isn't a kind of, the thing about a persona is that there should be, people should coalesce around it. Everybody should agree on it. Everybody should support it. And if you feel that you're getting dissent within your organization and splinter groups are going off and running their marketing in different ways, then I think you have to go back to it and say, well, for whatever reason, because it isn't a perfect science, for whatever reason, we either didn't get the persona right or we didn't bring it to life in the right way, and you know, maybe go back and kind of start again. But yeah, in terms of if you've got good personas, how do you keep them up to date? I think a lot of it does depend on what's going on externally. If there isn't a lot changing in the world, then they might be good for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. If there's a lot going on or your organization's changing, you might need to go back to them and just sort of check in every 6 months.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. It, it depends what you're using them for as well, because again, kind of like if you're designing a new website, that would probably be a good time to be really looking at your personas and making sure you're ticking the boxes for different personas. And if you haven't kind of got enough information within that persona, you might go and do some more user research, or, you know, find some more information and develop them a bit further. So yeah, it's kind of what's happening externally and what's happening internally as well.
Mm. Yeah, that's brilliant. One last question is actually about user research, because I think it would be quite helpful for listeners. Is if you are a small or micro charity and you don't have huge funds to perform user research, how would you have this sort of regular? Because it's something we actually come across quite a lot, is that regular user research is quite difficult. Is there any free cost-effective ways that you could suggest that people could, you know, on a Wednesday afternoon go and do a little bit of user research, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you've got people that you've got data for, there isn't anything wrong with going out yourself. I mean, I have clients that I work for that could afford to go to a market research agency and still would choose to do some of their qualitative research themselves. You know, there's nothing to be ashamed of in doing your own market research. Better to be doing it than not doing it at all. So I would try to make it reasonably formal. You know, I think that it needs to be more than a chat. So, you know, think about what questions that you want to ask, have a little bit of formality between yourself and the respondent, you know, so that they know that they're participating in something that's going to input into your strategy, because people will think a little bit more about what they're doing then. And just set some time aside for it. You know, I mean, you said a Wednesday afternoon. You know, I've had lots of clients that'll say to staff, well, can't you just do a few of these interviews in your lunch break? You still need to put some time aside for it to make it work. But you can definitely do your own research, you know, and even if you don't have contacts of people that you can go and talk to, just go and find some people, you know, just go talk to them, but think about what they've come back. Don't let that just sit in your head. You know, you need to analyze that and produce some kind of deliverable for your colleagues so that everybody can benefit from them. Otherwise it isn't market research, it's just a chat.
I agree. I think little and often can be really, really helpful. I was working with a local authority a couple of years ago on a website redesign, and we used to go to the library kind of once a week for an hour, and we had questions. We had an iPad or a computer, and we'd just kind of be like, oh, do you have time to chat for 5-10 minutes? And you could get kind of 4 or 5 responses within an hour, and we just kind of do that regularly, and we might tweak the questions depending on where we were with the website development. We might show them, we might do some like user testing or but I think just some, so if you've got an event that you're on, kind of maybe have someone in the team with an iPad with some questions on, how did you find out about this, what did you like, you know, whatever those questions might be. But it only has to be like 5 minutes chatting with someone. And I genuinely believe that you can get some really interesting insights just from a really brief chat with someone. So I would say bring that back to the team. And again, ideally, because of bias, it's you should be looking at it together and seeing any kind of similarities or things that you want to take forward, rather than it being one person doing it all the time. So you could alternate who does the questions. You could collectively in a team meeting kind of look at the answers and kind of see what that means. But yeah, it like an hour a week would actually be loads to a small charity. Like you could get quite a lot in that time. I'm a big believer of little and often.
And think about the things that people tell you at the end of the questions, because often those little nuggets that people say at the end of an interview or a conversation are the things definitely that help you go forward, rather than the questions that you specifically asked. It's a little bit like when you're leaving a meeting, you know, it's the little conversation that you have in the lift that gives you the nuggets of information.
Yeah, 100%. And I think it's that flexibility of have your questions, but don't be afraid to kind of ask a follow-up question that gets a bit because you're going on a particular route of conversation and that can gather some additional insight. So, yeah.
And observe as well. It isn't just about the conversation that you're having. It's about, you know, the interaction that you have with the person. You know, have they got children with them that are competing for their attention? You know, think about the person that you're talking to.
Yeah, definitely.
Brilliant. Well, that's all we have time for. But there was so much there to take away. So thank you both so much for joining us. Hope you'll join us again soon. For our listeners, thank you also. Our next podcast in a couple of weeks is appropriately on the cost of living crisis and the ways that charities can navigate that. So we'll see you then, and thanks again to our guests.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this Charity Digital podcast. The views, thoughts and opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not represent the views, thoughts and opinions of Charity Digital. The material and information presented here is for general information purposes only. Thanks for listening.